It's nothing new. It's been going on for years. A generational curse, it causes so many tears. It generates so much hurt, it causes so many fears. They lock him up, lock them up, they consider us peers. They label us murderer, burglar, and our future goes no further.
This is Not in Isolation, Voices of Youth. I am your host, Ronaldo Villeda, and today we will be discussing Kalief Browder. This tragic story is not uncommon, and like many others, he too succumbed to the brokenness caused by his wrongful incarceration, 700 days of which he spent in solitary. With me today is my co-host, Sway
Pineda,
and together we will dive deeper into Kalief's story, how the system failed him, and ultimately cost him his life.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Just a little bit about myself. You know, 24 years old, born and raised in Orange County, formerly incarcerated myself. And so just firsthand experience navigating the carceral system, all the factors that kind of led me to that. And then now being on the other side, right, working with young people coming home, people that kind of fell victim to the same cycles as myself, trying to create a different alternative, a different route for people like us. At the end of this, you know, we're all fighting the same fight, but, you know, we're all here to kind of ensure that these stories don't continue to happen, that our young people don't fall victim to these same vicious cycles of incarceration, police brutality, solitary confinement. And so, yeah, we're going to get into it.
We'll get into it, brother. Kalief Browder was 16 years old in 2010, when he was arrested for a robbery. Essentially, what happened is he was out one night with his friends. I think he had gone to a party. They were going home. It was late at night. You know, NYPD officers approached him. He believed it to be a stop and frisk situation, which was common in New York. It turned out he was a suspect of a robbery. So he was arrested, taken to the station, and he was interrogated.
That wasn't a man. That wasn't a grown man. That was a 16-year-old child.
During their interrogation, they asked Kalief if he had committed the crime. He said he had not, and he was adamant about his innocence. Due to Kalief being on probation from a previous incident that occurred 8 months before, he was arrested at 16 and sent to Rikers. At the time, New York was one of two states that would sentence kids as young as 16 or try them as adults, which meant they would be housed in adult facilities, which was Rikers. Kalief was then put on a probation hold due to his previous case.
We don't get the slap on the wrist like a lot more affluent or, you know, unfortunately, a lot of, you know, white communities. Like the privileges that they're granted from the beginning, we have to fight for.
Bail being the biggest one.
Oh, yeah.
Bail was set at $3,000. Because of this robbery and him being the suspect of it, he had a total of 30 court dates, spent 3 years inside, 700 days in solitary confinement before his case was dismissed and he was released.
700 days. Imagine what your mind is going through. Imagine what you're thinking of. On top of that, there's a lot of reasons why, like, it couldn't move forward, you know, 31 court appearances, 8 different judges, and no reason as to why this person should have remained in custody for that long.
Yeah, and I didn't know that. And to that point, yeah, his case was prolonged. The DA was on vacation. You know, they kept waiving time. The fact of the matter is, this 16-year-old boy spent 3 years inside of Rikers before he was let home. And because of the trauma and the experiences he had with coming in contact with the system through incarceration, it was something that affected Kalief profoundly to the point where he decided to take his own life after being released, which is a cold reminder of what solitary confinement can do to young men and women across the nation.
This is a very important case when we talk about solitary confinement. And although there are like unique details to his, it's not an uncommon thing for people to end up in situations as Khalif. We just passed like the anniversary of his passing, you know, June 6, 2015 was when he passed. You know, it brings up memories of like what young people have to go through, you know, in a state of like policing and hypercriminalization, you know, brings up, we could bring it back to Met Till, we could bring it back to Trayvon Martin. You know, Khalif Browder was another person who fell victim of an oppressive system. But it's not an uncommon thing. Like any one of us who have kind of navigated coming from an area that's, you know, impoverished, hyper-policed, kind of went through the carceral system, went through the school-to-prison pipeline. You know, we could have at any instant ended up in the same situation as him. Most of us can understand what it's like to grow up in an environment where police or law enforcement doesn't bring us a sense of safety. You know, we see cops and the first thing we do is we worry, we get nervous, even though we know we're not doing anything wrong. You know, it highlights this problem that exists in our country. It highlights a problem that you probably won't navigate if you happen to live in a zip code that's a bit more affluent. I remember for myself, like learning years later about what the school to prison pipeline was. When I first heard that terminology, I wasn't thinking about the grand scheme of thing. I wasn't thinking about the systemic issues. I was just like, damn, that's my life right there. If you kind of grew up in an area that you tend to see, you know, a lot of law enforcement, gang units, school resource officers.
Just over policing.
Yeah, like their presence is a huge factor in the school to prison pipeline. And I remember, you know, I think my first time ever being in kind of like on the wrong side of law enforcement, I think I was about, I want to say 12 years old. I was in my elementary school, sixth grade at that time. You know, our school had chosen to adopt this GRIP program. And for those who don't know, it's the Gang Reduction Intervention Program, right? It's kind of presented to schools, you know, as a means of intervention and prevention.
It's a diversion alternative program for youth that schools can't seem to get a grasp on or have the behavioral issues, right?
Well, on paper, right? But in reality, when you see it in practice, it just means that when these law enforcement officers, they identify any youth who is in proximity, has any relations, siblings to gangs, they become a target. It's not just exclusive to gangs. It also has to deal with just any behavioral issues. Now, you don't just deal with, like, you know, your principal, your counselor, whoever it is that's disciplining you. If it's a fight, if it's truancies, if it's anything that's deemed to be addressed, like, if it's meant to be addressed with this zero tolerance mentality, now you also have to deal with the law enforcement officer. And so easily, from a young age, from elementary school, you can see kids such as myself, such as, you know, any of our peers that are now have a target on them. But they've already been identified by law enforcement. And this sets them up. If you happen to be unlucky and now you happen to, you know, have this encounter, you have kind of this negative rapport with these law enforcement officers. They tell you, they track you, you know. They follow you, they find out where your neighborhood is from, they find out who your siblings are. And so it makes it more likely for them to police you.
Yeah, it's a way for them to begin to categorize us and differentiate us from the rest of our peers, essentially. Something that Khalif was not new to as well. He was born into the foster system. He was adopted, lived in a home with his brothers. And, you know, he basically grew up in the system. He was in foster care. He was a part of the school-to-prison pipeline. And ultimately, it's what led him to his incarceration. You know, he was marked from the beginning. The odds were stacked against him, just like many of us in our communities when we come into contact with these systems. And it's mind-blowing to me how young of an age we come into contact with these systems and become, I guess, diagnosed as kids with, you know, the behavioral and the criminalization of our behavior.
You know, it's this theme, right, where they treat us like problems before they treat us like people. You know, it's a vicious life for, you know, young people to have to, you know, not even be able to enjoy their innocence, not even be able to kind of learn from their mistakes because, you know, there's no kind of, oftentimes a lot of young people don't get this opportunity for redemption. If a young person makes a mistake, they steal things, you know, a young person wouldn't have to go to great lengths to learn like the error of their ways. And then a lot of these things can be done without law enforcement, without having to be in custody, without having to be incarcerated. But we see that for a lot of communities of color, like that's exactly what we have to deal with. You know, we can't just make amends and say sorry and ask for forgiveness and move forward with our lives.
It's a clear sign of the brokenness of our system as a whole. And Khalif humanizes all of the youth who have fallen through the cracks of this system. I think every aspect of his case, once you peel back the layers, just continue to reaffirm how we do not serve our children. We do not look out for their best interests. And in this circumstance, doing it because he's just another cog in the machine, and just really like humanizing his experiences, because he spent 700 days inside of solitary confinement. And we saw the effects it had on his young mind and ultimately what it led to in his story.
Khalif was a catalyst, I think, to open up these conversations and take them more seriously. And the young man was in Rikers Island, you know, gladiator school, which is known to be one of the most vicious institutions. And he was innocent. He had no reason to be there. And on top of already being in a hyper-violent environment, and that's by everybody. I think anybody that's part of the institution, I think, adopts a certain level of violence because that's what it's made to be. It's not meant to be a place of healing. It's not meant to be a place of restoration. It's just, you know, a place where people are just kind of surviving at any means necessary. And so you put a young man in there in a time when the mind of a young person, an undeveloped mind of a young person, you know, so many things contain it. So many things can damage it, you know, trauma being one. So you take somebody, you don't give them the means to basically cope with the traumatic experiences he had to live. You know, he was assaulted by both inmates, officers. And the traumatic experience alone for being arrested, taken from your family, taken from your community for something you did not do, that itself, and then you stack up all these other things, and then you place them in a 12, you know, by a 12 by 12 room, probably even smaller.
It's 12 by 8?
12 by 8, you know?
I'm not sure. I need it. Yeah.
And you put him in there for 700 days. That's torture. That's not punishment. Those aren't consequences. That's torture. And this person wasn't being affirmed. This person was being uplifted. This person was there probably to sit with all these negative thoughts and let them stack and stack and stack and stack. And there was no intention of helping him.
Yeah, there wasn't. And he experienced, you know, the violence inside because he's with grown men. And the entire time he was there, he always maintained his innocence. And to sit there experiencing the harshest punitive punishment that our government can give you, you know, solitary confinement. And just personally from being incarcerated, I can't imagine how Khalif felt. But I also know that to keep your sanity in such a place is one of the hardest things that I have ever had to do in my life. And I didn't spend nearly as much time as Khalif did inside solitary.
Real quick, just kind of wanted to throw in, like, just, I think the ineffectiveness of solitary confinement. You know, when you look at, like, prisons, they separate certain people from general population. They'll put them in the SHU. Solitary confinement doesn't stop anything, you know? It doesn't stop communication from the outside world. Some heavy hitters that are put away in solitary, and they still have means to connect. They still have means to communicate with people. Whatever the intentions were behind it, unless it was to make people suffer, then it's, I think it's doing exactly that, right? But solitary confinement has been an ineffective means to address whatever issues that corrections officers identify this individual, this inmate, this person to be perpetrating. If it's just a means to erase and separate or isolate, to an extent it does that. To an extent. If it's to dehumanize, it does it very well. But I don't think solitary confinement has done anything to minimize the damage that's being done inside these facilities. I think to an extent, it's just adds another layer to it. And it's an outdated system. It's an outdated punitive act. And it's torturous. And, you know, for a country that seems to be so, prides itself in being such a,
the land of the free, yeah, the home of the brave.
You know what I'm saying? We pride ourselves in being such a model for other countries to look after, right? We're
the world's leading incarcerator, though.
You know what I'm saying? It's counterproductive to where we should be as a society.
It is. And it's counterproductive to what what we stand for as a country. For Khalif, it was the lack of mental health, right? The lack of healing, the lack of support, the lack of love and compassion, empathy, that ultimately resulted in his demise. He's 16 years old. He's a young boy who grew up in the system, who was traumatized perpetually throughout his life. And solitary was the last nail in the coffin. And for me, when I think about Khalif, it shows that the status quo and what we have currently and have upheld as our prison system fails us every single time.
When we see prisons, jails, detention centers, there's no intention to rehabilitate. There's no intention to teach you like how to make amends, there's no restorative practices that are taught in there. You know, when you're in these facilities, you just sit there and you think and you adapt, but there's no real intention to rehabilitate these individuals. Juvenile hall, to an extent, they're adopting things more and more. But I think what we see is that there needs to be this clear, uncompromisable plan to rehabilitate, plan to reconnect, like plan for reentry, right? When Khalif Browder was probably released, they just set him off without a care, without any guidance, right? There was no kind of reentry strategy.
There was no continuity of care.
Exactly. And so they basically let him out and told him, figure it out. You got this. You're free now. Figure it out.
You spent this long inside.
Yeah.
But
there was no compensation. And so it's just like, how do you get better? How do you heal from that when there's no intention of showing you how to do that? There's no intention of connecting you with the resources, the support system you need to heal. So I think these are the problems. What do you do from here? And I think, one, let's just start off with the very basic, this isn't an impossible thing. You treat these people like people. You know, they're not disposable. Khalif wasn't just an individual. Khalif had a community. He had friends.
He had a family.
He was a person who was just entirely removed. When you look at these individuals as just criminals, when you look at them as disposable, it's easy, right, to subject them to these inhumane treatments, inhumane conditions. But when you treat them like people, it gets much harder to do that. When you humanize them, when you look at him, that's somebody's baby. You treat him like such, you know. And I'm not saying like baby him. I'm not saying dehumanize. I'm not saying like, but that's a 16-year-old. Like, that's not a grown individual. That's somebody that's still trying to figure out life. Give them the opportunity to do that, you know. So let's start there. Let's start there. How do we move forward? Like, I think the punitive system has enough resources available to be able to start implementing, you know, these restorative practices, these opportunities to create these habilitative programs. I'm doing away with solitary confinement. That's kind of why we're here, right? We're part of this Stop Solitary for Kids campaign, you know? And I think there's a lot of people with this same goal in mind. There's a lot of people that want to see, you know, these inhumane systems just eradicated. And we'll get there. I know we will, but we got to start. And I think implementing more means of rehabilitation, implementing more means of mental health services, normalizing it, and then giving people, you know, a transition plan so they can reconnect with, you know, these resources in the community. And especially if they're innocent.
Exactly.
I think the same institution that housed them for this long should be the same ones that are at least giving them the means or giving them the access to certain resources in the community that are going to help them undo the trauma that they just endured for whatever amount of time that they were in custody for. But we'll get there.
Yeah, we're working on it.
Yep.
You know, there's a whole movement out here, and there's many great organizations and programs that dedicate their life's work to helping, you know, my peers come home, helping me come home. You know, we had Elizabeth Calvin on here. There is a light at the end of the tunnel, and we're actively working on these things. So it's something that, you know, Khalif, in a sense, was that catalyst as well for the change. You know, his story and what he experienced showed us how miserably we were failing. You know, it prompted a lot of people to get involved and do something about it.
My name is Jenny Lutz. I'm an attorney with the Center for Children's Law and Policy, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit working to help protect the rights and the safety of young people. I'm also the director of one of our projects, which is called Stop Solitary for Kids. We work around the country to end the use of solitary confinement for all young people through resources, through training, and through other projects like this podcast. There's often a fundamental misunderstanding of what solitary confinement actually looks like for young people. That's partly because it goes by other neutral sounding names like room confinement, seclusion, or separation. But it's also because most people don't think that this can be happening to young people, that we can be putting kids in solitary confinement, or that if it is happening, it's not like what we imagine solitary confinement is for adults. But the truth is that solitary confinement is happening to young people, it's happening across the country, and it's just as harmful as what we imagine happens for adults. Solitary confinement is putting children in cells smaller than the size of a parking space with no human contact for days, weeks, or even months. There's usually just a bed and a thin mattress, nothing else in the cell or on the cell walls. There might be a tiny opening for light to come in, and food usually comes through a small slot-like opening in the door. We've even heard about kids being forced to use the bathroom in plastic bags if there isn't a metal toilet in the solitary cell. And this happens to 1 in 3 young people in jails or prisons. That's tens and thousands of young people a year. Solitary confinement also causes profound harm, especially to young people or adolescents. It increases their risk of suicide and trauma. We know that half of suicides of young people inside jails or prisons happen in solitary confinement. Most young people in solitary don't get services, mental health treatment, drug and alcohol counseling, or even education that they're legally entitled to. There are also skills that teenagers should be learning during this period of their lives that allow them to become adjusted and capable adults. Those are skills like navigating relationships, making good decisions in the face of conflict, but no child can learn those skills locked up in a tiny isolation cell. We also know that solitary confinement affects kids of color, kids struggling with mental wellness, and LGBTQI+ youth more than others. On top of this, we know that solitary confinement doesn't work. The most common reason that jails and prisons give for using solitary is that some kids must be separated and locked down to keep everyone else safe or to teach them a lesson. This idea is part of a larger narrative, a false narrative, that young people who get caught up in the system, who are usually black and brown kids, are somehow more dangerous or less worthy of compassion. Just to use an example, most people listening today wouldn't lock their child in a closet or a small space for hours or days when they're experiencing difficulties or challenges and expect that young person to come out of that space having figured out better conflict resolution or behavioral skills on their own just by virtue of being isolated. When we put kids in solitary confinement, we're also teaching them the lesson that the person or the group who has the most control or force wins. And that's not the approach that we want any young person to have in the community when they may encounter conflict. So the goal of Stop Solitary for Kids is to take apart destructive practices like solitary, not only through laws and policies and court orders, but also by calling out the culture of incarceration, punishment, and racism that we see in the system around us and in the use of solitary confinement. And fortunately, there have been victories across the country where places have ended the use of solitary confinement for young people. It's possible. That means pushing jails, prisons, and judges to see that there are better ways. Those better ways are strategies like treating kids as human beings with potential, building relationships with young people, training staff to solve problems with their words and not physical force, getting mental health staff and therapists involved, and giving young people in custody meaningful activities to do and skills that make future opportunities like jobs or pursuing their education real opportunities for them. Many of these approaches also aren't just coming from advocates like Stop Solitary for Kids and our partners. Jails, prisons, and staff who work there are also saying, hey, there are other approaches that work better and that actually do make everyone safer. There are also young people who are speaking out, who've been in solitary confinement, and who can describe what would have worked better instead for them than solitary confinement. Our goal in this podcast series is to lift up the voices, expertise, and the vision of young people. We can't make these changes without them. This project is possible through support from Arnold Ventures and the Jacob and Valeria Langeloth Foundation. We would also like to thank the family of Kalief Browder, the Kalief Browder Foundation, and everyone who helped support Time, the Kalief Browder Story documentary series.
Join us next time for a discussion about alternatives and changes that we're seeing across the country from organizers and advocates dedicated to ensuring that more young people get the services that they deserve. Because as Sway mentioned, one story like Kalief's is one too many.